Welcome to Udemy Research from our Algorithms for Life series by Valor Engels.
In this deep dive, we are tackling what we call the paradox of possibility. It's this persistent, almost frustrating struggle that so many high-achieving leaders and, you know, strategists and idea generators face.
And here's the core of the paradox, right?
Yeah.
The very same minds that are capable of conjuring up the most innovative strategic vision, I mean, they're seeing 10 potential futures at once.
Mm-hmm.
They're often the exact same minds that struggle profoundly with the sustained, disciplined execution you need to build just one of those futures.
Exactly. And it feels like a willpower issue, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
But our mission today is to really explore the data that proves it's not a character flaw. It's not poor discipline.
It's a design problem.
It's a structural design problem. The cognitive architecture that is so optimized for generating massive strategic vision, that high openness, novelty-seeking mind, it systematically undermines the long horizon follow-through needed for implementation.
So it's literally your neurobiology operating as designed.
Precisely. But it's creating all this friction in, you know, the modern professional environment.
Okay, so we've synthesized a whole stack of sources today to move us past that feeling of self-blame and straight into practical system design. Our goal for you, the listener, is to understand this architecture and then start designing external systems protocols that work with your traits, not constantly fighting against them.
And we'll be looking at some really surprising and powerful data today. For instance, there's a 2024 meta-analysis that shows overall human AI collaboration actually underperforms on average.
Underperforms.
Yeah, measured by a Hedges Dree of minus 0.23. And we'll compare that really counterintuitive finding to the immense quantified leverage of a single simple intervention implementation intentions.
And those have a huge effect size.
Huge. A D score of 0.65 on goal attainment.
Those numbers are massive, and we will definitely unpack what they mean for your daily decision making. But first, let's just quickly define the key terms that are really central to this research and our discussion.
Okay, we need three foundational terms. First up, openness to experience.
This is one of the key dimensions of the Big Five personality model. It's what drives imagination, that intellectual curiosity, creativity, and a really strong preference for variety. It's the cognitive engine, really, that generates all the possibilities and sees connections everywhere.
Right. Then second, we have maybe the most potent tool in our arsenal today, implementation intentions.
These are those highly structured if-then plans. They're designed explicitly to automate the start of a behavior, basically building a cognitive bridge that spans that notorious gap between having a good intention and, you know, actually taking the first step.
And finally, a term that's crucial for understanding the devastating cost of multitasking and strategic switching, attention residue.
This was documented by Dr. Sophie Leroy back in 2009. Attention residue is the phenomenon where part of your cognitive focus stays anchored to a prior task, even after you've mentally or physically switched your attention to a new one.
It's a literal loss of processing power.
Exactly. It's because your brain hasn't fully logged out of the last project.
Okay, so let's unpack this structural problem. If you're a visionary, a high achiever, the constant pressure isn't just about execution, it's the execution in the middle of this abundance of opportunity.
So why does having many great opportunities fundamentally break our ability to execute on just one?
It really begins with the simple kind of frustrating physics of the brain. The first structural limitation is the sheer cost of context switching, which is, I mean, it's mandatory for anyone trying to juggle multiple complex initiatives.
And this is where the high openness thinkers, the ones who naturally generate and want to pursue all these paths, just hit a wall.
They hit a wall. And this isn't just a subjective feeling of, oh, I'm busy. Your sources provide cold, hard data on the quantified costs of this switching.
We're not talking about a small dip in efficiency here, are we?
Not at all. Research on context switching indicates that a staggering 20% of your cognitive capacity is lost every single time a switch occurs.
20%.
Imagine a computer running a critical program, and every time you click away, a fifth of its processing power just vanishes.
That's devastating. And if you're a leader whose day involves constant shifts from, say, a budget review to talent strategy to product ideation, that loss just compounds immediately.
And the cost doesn't even end there. The sources detail the punitive recovery time. It takes over 20 minutes for full cognitive recovery after a significant task switch.
Wow.
And this isn't just about settling in. It's the actual time needed for your executive function to regain optimal clarity and focus on the new context.
So if I switch between three strategic initiatives in 1 hour, which, let's be honest, is pretty common in complex environments, I could potentially spend 40 to 60 minutes of that hour just trying to get my cognitive engine back up to speed.
That's it. Which means your most high-value, high-complexity work is being done at 80% capacity for most of the day. That is the hidden cost of being a visionary.
And this brings us right back to attention residue.
Right. The brain is not this purely rational machine that just instantly logs out of a task when you tell it to. It keeps processing the former task in the background.
Yeah.
And the research highlights that this residue gets significantly worse when you anticipate time pressure on the task you just left.
Okay, so let me get this straight. If I'm working intensely on Initiative A, which has a massive deadline, and I have to quickly jump to Initiative B for a mandatory meeting, the urgency and complexity of Initiative A, I mean, a huge chunk of my cognitive resources are still back there, mentally solving for A while I'm physically present trying to analyze B.
That's the exact friction.
Yeah.
It's the brain prioritizing unfinished business. And for the high openness mind that sees the high stakes in every single project it starts, that residue is immense. We just have severely limited processing resources for managing multiple complex initiatives at the same time.
This limitation has been established for years, right? I'm thinking of researchers like Luck and Vogel who define the constraint on our working memory capacity.
Correct. Working memory capacity, that's the number of items we can actively hold and manipulate in our conscious mind, is typically limited to a notoriously low range, 4 to 7 items.
And I've seen some contemporary research that suggests 4 is probably more realistic when you're dealing with really complex strategic data.
It's very realistic. So if you are managing, say, 3 different strategic verticals, and each one has its own nested goals, dependencies, stakeholder details, and metrics,
you're instantly blowing past that 4 to 7 item capacity.
Immediately.
Yeah.
And the consequence is immediate degradation. Your decision quality suffers, details get corrupted, and the brain starts creating these simplifying assumptions that often lead to critical errors down the line. The visionary mind, which is driven by possibility and constantly generating new complexity, is structurally designed to overload its own processing unit.
So the problem isn't that you're lazy.
Not at all.
Yeah.
The problem is that you are trying to demand more working memory space than the human brain actually possesses.
That leads directly to that subjective feeling of exhaustion. If the high possibility mind is constantly overloading its capacity, it must feel intensely stressful.
And that stress is actually quantifiable as the psychology of opportunity cost. Kurzban and his colleagues developed this fascinating model where the subjective experience of mental effort isn't just resource depletion, it's something else.
Okay.
Mental strain is the brain's high-level computation of the value of alternative uses that you give up by committing to a single option.
Wait, let me make sure I'm following that. The reason I feel exhausted when I'm deciding between two equally good paths isn't just the decision itself, it's my brain running these continuous complex calculations on the massive potential value of the path I didn't choose.
That is the conceptual model. When your strategic options are abundant and compelling, your brain expends immense energy calculating the potential regret or the lost benefits of the 9 paths you are consciously suppressing to focus on just the one.
So that mental calculation increases the subjective feeling of strain.
It does. If you have 10 potential breakthrough ways to spend your quarter, the act of executing on option 1 feels 9 times harder than it would if you only have 1 option to begin with.
And this struggle must be amplified when the options are qualitatively different, when they involve what the research calls value incommensurability.
Absolutely amplified. Decision-making becomes qualitatively harder when your initiatives involve fundamentally different types of benefits that you just can't reduce to a common objective currency.
Can you give an example of that?
Sure. How do you objectively compare the strategic value of, let's say, Initiative Alpha, a long-term research project that secures a deep technological advantage 6 years from now, versus Initiative Beta, which is a short-term commercial venture that generates high cash flow immediately?
Right. One offers immediate security and market dominance today, and the other offers insurance against becoming obsolete and future market leadership. Oh. They're measuring success on completely different timescales with different definitions of value.
You can't reduce them to a single metric. You can't just optimize the choice, because the optimization criteria themselves are in conflict.
So what happens to the decision maker?
Well, the sources detail that people selecting between these incommensurable options report significantly greater decision difficulty, lower post-decision satisfaction, and this is the most important part, higher anticipated regret, no matter which choice they make.
the psychological pain is baked into the selection process itself.
It is, because that cost calculation, Kurzban's model, it never stops running in the background. It's the constant low-level drone of, what if I picked the wrong six-year path?
Precisely. And this is why abundance is so paralyzing. It's a concept demonstrated even on a consumer scale. I'm thinking of the classic Iyengar and Leper study from 2000, the JAM study.
A fantastic example. They show that presenting customers with 24 options versus just six led to less engagement and, you know, fewer actual purchases.
For the visionary mind, every new idea is a new jar of jam. If you keep stocking the shelves, you eventually just stop choosing, paralyzed by the sheer volume of possibility.
And this overwhelming sense of possibility is driven by personality. That high openness trait is our strategic engine. But let's look at the tension between that visionary trait and the execution trait.
Right. The foundational point here is recognizing that the two critical dimensions for success in these complex endeavors, openness to experience, which is imagination and variety, and conscientiousness, which is discipline and organization, are structurally orthogonal dimensions.
Meaning they operate independently. You can score high on one without having a corresponding high score on the other.
And that independence is the structural issue we're talking about, right? The visionary's greatest strength is housed in a cognitive system that doesn't inherently prioritize follow through.
That's the structural gap. The visionary high openness mind is superb at divergent thinking, seeing possibilities, making these rapid cognitive leaps. But it is not guaranteed to be effective at convergent thinking, the focused, sustained effort you need to hammer out a single solution.
So if you start with high openness and, say, average conscientiousness, the cognitive challenge is constant and it's trait-based.
What does the research on high performers, like entrepreneurs, tell us about how this tension actually plays out in the real world?
Well, the Zhao and Seibert meta-analysis is highly instructive here. They compared successful entrepreneurs with traditional managers and found that entrepreneurs scored significantly higher on both openness, with an effect size of D equals plus 0.36, and conscientiousness at plus 0.45.
Okay, so that suggests that the most successful individuals, the ones who managed to transform vision into massive reality, either possess that rare, natural, high-high combination.
Or, and this is key for our listeners, they figured out how to build external scaffolding to bolster their execution capabilities.
Exactly. For the vast majority who do not possess that natural balance, the struggle is constant because of the underlying neurobiology of novelty seeking.
This is where I want to push back just a little bit. If the pursuit of novelty is what leads to strategic breakthroughs, why should we try to suppress it? It sounds like we're saying our best trait is also our biggest flaw.
That's the nuance we have to explore. We aren't suggesting suppression, we're suggesting compensation. Research from Sethi and colleagues in 2018 shows why this trait causes execution failure. They found that high novelty seeking leads individuals to choose novel options even when those options are objectively suboptimal.
So it's not about optimizing for success.
No. It's about optimizing for the immediate dopamine hit of a new start. The reward system is firing for the act of exploration, regardless of whether that exploration leads to a viable strategic outcome.
It's like your brain gives you a trophy just for registering for the marathon, even if you never finish the race.
Exactly. And furthermore, novelty seeking correlates with slower reward learning rates. The high openness mind needs more data points, more attempts to differentiate between optimal and non-optimal choices in a complex environment.
So the pull of the new possibility is strong enough to override a rational, objective assessment of strategic value.
Which leads to the chronic problem of premature switching. They launch initiative A, the novelty wears off, and the brain immediately switches to initiative B, which offers the next big dopamine hit.
This is perfectly described by Dr. William Dodson's model of the interest-based nervous system. It's a concept often applied to ADHD, but it really captures the motivational dynamics of any highly divergent, high-openness mind.
In that model, motivation is driven primarily by interest and fascination, rather than the traditional drivers of, you know, responsibility or importance. This explains the phenomenon of hyperfocus, that ability to intensely engage when the task is stimulating and new.
But it also explains the sharp, immediate disengagement when a strategic initiative moves from the exciting, creative exploration phase to the less stimulating, more detailed execution phase.
Right. So when the project moves from building the prototype to scaling the distribution network, the 80% of the work that's routine and difficult, the novelty drive just diminishes. The mind is already formulating the next strategic vision, leaving the current project orphaned.
The maintenance phase of a project just doesn't generate the same level of internal reward as the ignition phase.
And if your nervous system is built to crave ignition, you will struggle fiercely with the steady, necessary maintenance required for long-term success.
Okay, so if the problem is neurobiological and structural, our solution has to be structural and external. We need to find the high-leverage tools, the research-validated interventions that compensate directly for these trait-based vulnerabilities. This is where the science gets really practical.
Right. We're looking for strategies that automate execution and simplify decision-making, things that reduce cognitive load and help us bypass that novelty trap.
If we're looking for maximum leverage, we have to start with implementation intentions. You said the effect size is immense. Give us the full statistical weight of this finding.
This is the critical takeaway for any visionary trying to execute. Peter Galwitzer's seminal 1999 meta-analysis, which was this comprehensive review aggregating data from 94 separate studies, found an overall effect size of D equals 0.65 on goal attainment.
Okay, put that in perspective for us.
In psychological research, an effect size above D equals 0.50 is considered large. So this is a remarkably robust and powerful finding for such a simple cognitive tool.
And the effects are strongest right where the high openness mind is weakest, just getting started and staying focused.
Exactly. The meta-analysis showed the effects were highest for getting started at D equals 0.83, and for preventing that inevitable derailment at D equals 0.77. This mechanism directly targets the point of friction, the moment the novelty-seeking brain usually starts computing opportunity costs and looking for a distraction.
So how does this simple if-then statement create such a powerful neurological change? What's the actual mechanism?
You can visualize it as building a kind of cognitive fast lane. A standard goal intention is just a destination. I will launch the new initiative this week. That requires conscious deliberation every morning.
Right. How will I start? When is the best time? What should I do first? And that deliberation is where the novelty seeker gets distracted.
And the implementation intention removes that deliberation. The, if this specific situation happens, then I will do this specific action format, forges these strong, automatic, context-dependent associations in the brain.
So when the trigger, the if part occurs, the brain just bypasses the slow deliberation circuit.
It does. It automatically initiates the intended action, the then part. It's basically putting your procedural memory in service of strategic action.
Give us a clear, practical example for a leader dealing with the problem we laid out in the first section.
Okay. Let's say the goal is completing initiative A. A powerful intention would be something like, if I complete my Monday team sync call, then I will immediately close all email applications and work on the most difficult task for initiative A for 90 minutes.
So the completion of that team sync becomes an automatic, non-negotiable cue to begin the execution.
Exactly. On the most important, least novel task.
And the evidence that this bypasses our executive function deficiencies, even for high impulsivity, is incredibly compelling.
It is. The Garrillo and Galwitzer 2008 study, using a proxy population of 98 boys with ADHD, provides really striking real-world evidence. They were tested on a delay of gratification task that was tied to real earnings.
Okay.
The control group, which only used goal intentions, earned an average of 2.82 euros. The group using implementation intentions earned 5.54 euros.
Nearly double.
Almost double. This demonstrates that the framework is powerful enough to compensate for some of the most significant executive function challenges inherent to that interest-based nervous system.
That is just proof that this system design, this cognitive scaffold, works even when an individual's internal wiring struggles with discipline.
But there's a critical nuance here in the meta-analysis related to this type of mind. It's the difference between self-direction and external facilitation.
What do you mean?
The research on something called mental contrasting with implementation intentions, or MCII, often known as WHOOP, involved over 15,000 participants. It found that experimenter-led protocols, which had a G of 0.465, significantly outperformed the self-directed versions, which were only at 0.277.
So why does the visionary need external help to set their own intentions?
It's because the high openness mind often sees external structure as the enemy of creativity. When left to their own devices, they might set vague or overly flexible intentions.
Which defeats the whole purpose.
Right. External support, a coach, a peer accountability partner, or even just a strict self-imposed template forces the necessary specificity in the if and then clauses. This external structure is what ensures the intentions are robust enough to truly automate the action, which is where all the leverage comes from.
Okay, so we need structure and often external guidance to set our intentions. Once that intention is set, we need accountability so we don't just switch to a shiny new idea after the 90 minutes is up. How much leverage does external accountability add?
The impact is immense, provided it's structured correctly. The Matthews 2007 study, which tracked 267 individuals, quantified this multiplier effect beautifully. The control group, which only had unwritten goals, achieved a self-reported score of 4.28.
And the other group?
When goals were shared with a supportive friend, combined with the crucial element of weekly written progress reports, the achievement score nearly doubled, reaching 8.4.
Weekly progress reporting combined with social support essentially doubles the likelihood of follow-through. That moves accountability from just a corporate necessity to a foundational algorithmic tool for execution.
And that word support is key. The research constantly stresses that the entire structure collapses if it lacks psychological safety. Accountability mechanisms that rely on fear or punitive measures or a blame-centric environment, they backfire dramatically.
I can see why. If the accountability is punitive, the visionary mind, which is already prone to avoiding routine and difficulty, will simply learn to hide problems, manage perception, and game the system rather than genuinely reporting obstacles and making progress.
Precisely. The structure needs to be designed to support vulnerability and problem solving, not enforce rigid, fear-based compliance. The goal isn't to punish the lack of execution. It's to make progress visible and to remove the roadblocks that all these switching cost problems impose.
This also validates the power of what are called commitment devices, which are another form of external friction we can impose on ourselves.
Commitment devices are powerful because they intentionally increase the cost of switching away from the chosen strategic path. For the novelty seeker who is constantly tempted by option B, a commitment device makes option A immediately more rewarding or option B immediately more costly.
Right.
Studies like those involving seed savings programs show a 30 to 50% completion improvement when individuals voluntarily tie resources or social penalties to their goals. If you know that abandoning initiative A now means sacrificing a week's budget, the inertia required to stick with it increases significantly.
Okay, but here is the core cognitive resistance for the visionary. The feeling that structure kills creativity. If I'm told what to do and when, how can I possibly innovate? But the research suggests that too much freedom is actually what's paralyzing.
That's the inverted U-curve of constraint and creativity. The Acar et al. Meta-analysis from 2019 confirmed that this relationship is curvilinear. Too few constraints lead to that opportunity overload and decision paralysis we talked about earlier.
But too many constraints, micromanagement, overspecification, they just crush your autonomous motivation and the high openness drive.
So the magic lies in finding the peak of that curve, the optimal zone of focus. We call this the minimum viable structure.
The MVS.
The MVS is the minimum amount of structure necessary to focus the restless, divergent mind while preserving the maximum amount of autonomous motivation. And research from self-determination theory, or SDT, confirms that autonomous motivation correlates really strongly with engagement. We're talking a correlation of R equals 0.40 to 0.60.
So if the structure feels like external control, the high openness mind just rebels and loses its internal motivation engine.
Exactly. This means structure needs to be experienced as support rather than enforcement. The Georgian Zoo study from 2001 demonstrated that high openness only predicted creative behavior when it was combined with appropriate environmental supports.
So in a chaotic environment, high openness just leads to scattershot results.
But in a structured yet supportive environment, it leads to genuine creative breakthroughs that actually get executed.
Yeah.
And this structure must feed the high openness mind's need for reward.
How so?
The structure has to be designed to make progress visible. This links back directly to the work of Teresa Amabile, whose research highlighted that small wins and observable progress on meaningful work are the strongest drivers of engagement and motivation.
So this is how you compensate for the novelty gap.
It is. You provide the motivational dopamine hit that the visionary brain craves, but you direct that reward toward the completion of the strategic initiative, not the start of a new one.
Let's talk about strategy at the highest level. We're moving from individual hacks to organizational frameworks. If the future is inherently uncertain, how do the truly expert portfolio managers, the people running multiple high-risk ventures, choose what to pursue?
Well, they often abandon the standard strategic planning model, which is based on causal logic. Causal logic is goals first. You set a massive goal, like capturing 30% of a market, and then you secure the resources and plan the steps to reach that target.
And the high openness mind finds that process restrictive and often inaccurate because the future is just unpredictable.
Correct. Instead, Sir Azathee's groundbreaking research on 27 expert entrepreneurs who ran high-growth companies worth between $200 million and $6 billion found they overwhelmingly relied on effectual logic 65% of the time.
Effectual logic being means first.
Precisely. They start with who they are, what they know, and who they know, their immediate means. They then use those means to identify immediate near-term paths that can create value, rather than trying to perfectly predict a distant market. They act, learn, and then adapt the strategy based on feedback.
This sounds inherently more compatible with the visionary mind, which thrives on flexibility and rapid pivoting.
It's the foundation of strategic agility. A core principle of effectuation is focusing on affordable loss rather than predicting massive returns. Instead of trying to forecast the ROI on a $10 million investment, they ask, what are we willing to lose? What time, money, or reputation to test this idea with the resources we have right now?
That reframes the risk completely.
It does. If the loss is affordable, the penalty for failure is low, and the ability to pivot is high, which is more valuable than your initial strategic selection.
That shifts the focus from optimizing the initial choice, which we already established is psychologically draining, to optimizing the process of learning and iterating.
It shifts the strategic advantage from prediction to control. The ability to manage uncertainty is valued over the ability to forecast it. And this framework is strongly supported by longitudinal studies of people who successfully manage multiple parallel ventures.
You're referring to the Santa Maria study on portfolio entrepreneurs.
Yes. The Santa Maria 2021 longitudinal study, which tracked over 5,700 entrepreneurs, found that the performance advantage of portfolio entrepreneurs came primarily from their ability to redeploy resources, money, people, knowledge across their businesses.
It did not necessarily come from them having superior initial opportunity selection.
That's right, which is a crucial insight. It reinforces the idea that the long-term success of the visionary is not determined by picking the single perfect idea on day one, but by having the systems in place that allow for efficient reassignment of talent and capital when the inevitable surprises occur.
The process of control trumps the effort of prediction.
We've established the cognitive limits attention residue, switching costs, that 4-7 item working memory limit. We've established the high leverage tools like implementation intentions and effectual logic. Now we build the system. And this requires integrating technology, specifically AI, in a way that compensates for our human flaws, not amplifying them.
Right. This section is all about creating actionable, trait-based systems, ensuring we use technology not just for the novelty of it, but for compensation and strategic advantage.
Let's revisit the most counterintuitive finding, the 2024 Vaccaro meta-analysis of 106 experiments. It showed that overall, human-AI collaboration resulted in a statistically significant underperformance.
A G-score of -0.23. Why did human intervention actually degrade the outcome?
This is a massive caution flag. The underperformance often occurred in simple decision-making tasks, where the human either introduced bias or, and this is more common, the friction of the interface and the collaboration method just slowed down or confused the process. The human contribution was essentially noise in a simple signal processing task.
So the problem wasn't the AI's capability, it was the human system interface.
Exactly. However, and this is the crucial moderator, this negative effect reverses completely for creative and generative tasks. When the task requires divergent thinking, synthesis of vast amounts of information, and the rapid generation of options, the domain of the high-openness mind collaboration shows significant gains.
This perfectly illustrates the centaur chess analogy. I think Kasparov coined that back in 2005.
Yes, and it remains paramount. Kasparov observed that in chess tournaments, a weak human player plus a machine plus a better process was superior to a strong human plus a machine plus an inferior process.
The quality of the collaboration methodology, the interface, the handoffs, it matters exponentially more than the raw capability of either the human or the AI.
If the process is broken, the output will be broken, regardless of the talent involved.
So if a leader starts using a generative AI tool to help with strategy, they need a defined protocol for its use, or they risk underperforming their old manual method.
Absolutely. We have to use AI as a cognitive compensator, particularly for the executive function gaps inherent to high-openness minds. And the sources suggest a unique advantage here. The EY Global Neuroinclusion Study from 2025 found that neurodivergent professionals were 55% more AI proficient.
That's fascinating. Why the outperformance for neurodivergent minds?
The hypothesis is that AI tools are highly effective at compensating for the specific challenges often associated with divergent thinking. Things like organization, managing large sets of unstructured data, tracking dependencies, documenting process. AI acts as a perfect external organizational scaffold, which allows the divergent mind to focus entirely on the generative side, the part it excels at.
So this requires defining clear roles to preserve our strategic judgment and avoid over-relying on the machine.
We have to be intentional. We need to clearly define where AI operates and where the human retains control. Use AI for data synthesis, for rapidly generating scenario models, for dependency mapping, managing the complexity we can't hold in working memory, and for generating a high volume of potential options.
But preserve human judgment for the truly novel functions.
Exactly. Strategic framing, value-based prioritization rooted in your tacit expertise, and the deliberate override decisions that rely on non-quantifiable intuition.
Okay, let's return to the core constraint. The 20% cognitive loss and 20-minute recovery time from context switching. Given those hard limits, what is the practical maximum number of complex initiatives a single visionary mind can manage at peak performance?
The conclusion from the sources is clear. The practical maximum is 2 to 3 concurrent active projects.
2 to 3.
The moment you push past 3, the sheer cost of context switching and the resulting attention residue rapidly push your overall productivity towards 0. You might feel productive because you're switching constantly, but you're effectively working at 60% capacity on 4 complex projects.
Which is worse than 100% capacity on 2.
So the visionary has to accept this constraint. But if they accept they can only execute 2 to 3 projects, how do they deal with the constant stream of new, compelling ideas they generate? You can't just throw away great ideas.
You don't throw them away. You manage them through staging. This is the critical mechanism for protecting your execution capacity while honoring that visionary input. We categorize initiatives rather than keeping them all active at the same time.
Okay, let's break down the 3 defined stages.
First, the active stage. This is 2 to 3 projects, maximum. These are the initiatives receiving regular attention, resources, and weekly triage. They are the focus of your limited executive function capacity.
Second is the maintenance stage. These are your established operations, legacy systems, projects that have reached maturity. They have defined minimal check-ins. They're stable and require very little cognitive load.
And the most important stage for protecting the high openness mind from itself, the pipeline.
The pipeline stage. These are the documented, compelling new opportunities, the brilliant ideas that emerge mid-quarter. They are clearly articulated and documented, but they are explicitly held and delayed for the next scheduled review, usually quarterly.
And that mechanism is crucial. It prevents the immediate pursuit, defusing the novelty trigger by scheduling its review.
Right. You honor the idea by documenting it in the pipeline, but you protect your capacity by committing to delay. That documentation in the pipeline reduces the anxiety of letting a good idea go. It mitigates that opportunity cost calculation we talked about.
Yeah.
Your brain knows it hasn't been forgotten, just postponed.
If the visionary mind is prone to constant strategic drift, it needs a governance rhythm, a cadence that physically and temporally separates the time for execution from the time for strategic reallocation. High-performing adaptive organizations rely on this predictable rhythm.
We need 3 distinct layers of review, from frequent tactical checks to infrequent structural overhaul. Let's start with the most frequent, weekly.
The weekly review has to be focused on execution triage. This meeting must be short, 30 to 60 minutes, and its purpose is singular, to remove roadblocks from the 2 to 3 active projects.
And you're reviewing input metrics here. Did we do the required work? Not outcomes. Amazon's weekly business review, the WBR, is the model here. Minimal reprioritization, maximum problem solving. The question is just, what stopped the team this week and how do we unstick it right now?
If you try to reprioritize weekly, you're just encouraging the attention residue cycle. You're saying that nothing is sacred.
Precisely. Reprioritization is a costly decision, and you have to protect against making those frequently. Which brings us to the monthly layer.
The monthly initiative health review.
This is the time to zoom out and validate the core assumptions of your active projects. This is where you test if the market signal is still responding to your strategy. You assess strategic health, not just task compliance.
Are the premises still sound? Is the affordable loss still affordable?
Exactly. But this is still not the time for major pivots or killing a project. It's about tactical adjustment and validating your course based on real-world feedback.
And finally, the time for the big structural decisions where we engage the pipeline. Quarterly.
The quarterly. Portfolio reallocation. This has to be treated as the only scheduled time for fundamental strategic shifts. This is when you make your kill continue decisions, evaluate the pipeline opportunities, and execute resource redeployment across the organization.
This is where you might apply a framework like the McKinsey 70-20-10 rule.
Right. 70% core, 20% adjacent, 10% new ventures. You're making sure your resources match your strategic appetite. This cadence is essential. It tells the high openness mind, yes, we see your brilliant new idea, but we have a dedicated scheduled time coming up to review it.
That predictability is what allows the visionary to settle back into execution.
It separates the big, strategic, slow, irreversible decisions from the tactical, fast ones that you delegate to the weekly triage. Our entire mission rests on engineering this minimum viable structure, or MVS, system. It has to be tailored to focus the high openness mind without crushing the autonomous motivation that makes that mind effective in the first place. So let's finalize the actionable system with the three key components.
Component one, explicit strategic direction.
This needs to be a single source of truth, a document that clearly specifies the 2 to 3 active initiatives, the precise reasoning for their selection, and this is the critical part for high openness minds, explicitly states what is not being pursued.
By explicitly stating what's off the table, you reduce that massive cognitive load from opportunity cost. For the opportunity abundant mind, knowing what not to worry about is often more valuable than knowing what to do.
It just shuts down those background calculations. Component two involves automating the initiation using the most powerful tool we discussed, implementation templates.
We need to move beyond simple goal intentions. We need pre-written if-then plans for the most common derailment triggers specific to an individual's executive function gaps.
And this includes the initiation plans, like if I sit down at my desk, then I open Initiative A's folder. They're also crucial continuation plans.
A great example of a continuation plan is one that mitigates the switching impulse.
Precisely. A template should address that novelty pull directly. If I feel the strong pull toward a new project, then I will document a ready-to-resume plan for my current task first and set a 20-minute timer before I make any decision to switch.
That ready-to-resume plan is such a powerful micro-intervention against attention residue. How does it work?
It takes less than 60 seconds. It's just the sub-minute documentation of exactly where you are in the current task and, more importantly, what the single next step is. You don't just say, I'm pausing. You write, I am paused on session 3.2. Next action is to verify the Q3 budget number for stakeholder X.
And research confirms this simple act of externalizing the next step reduces attention residue.
Because the brain feels less anxiety and less pressure about the context switch. The problem is documented and the path back is clear.
And the third and final component, visible progress measurement.
This is the reward system. The structure must be engineered so that small wins and clear progress on meaningful work are highly visible. This is how you compensate for the dopamine loss when the initial novelty wears off. Instead of getting a hit from starting something new, you get a continuous, steady stream of reward from observing your own visible strategic progress toward completion.
You make progress the most rewarding activity available to the novelty-seeking brain.
Essentially, you are tricking the interest-based nervous system into hyper-focusing on execution. You replace the dopamine rush of exploration with the satisfaction of continuous tracked accomplishment. The structure isn't a punishment for your creativity. It's a meticulously designed scaffold that makes it easy to move forward on the chosen few paths and difficult to move sideways into that paralyzing abundance of possibility.
We started with the paradox. The core cognitive architecture that generates your greatest strategic strength, the high openness, novelty-seeking mind, is simultaneously your greatest liability when it comes to long-term execution.
But the research confirms this visionary's paradox is structural. It's rooted in the neurobiology of working memory limits and attention residue. So the path to execution is not through brute force willpower, but through designing external systems that compensate for these trait-based vulnerabilities. It's about engineering the environment to support your mind.
Let's quickly consolidate the key high-leverage takeaways we've discussed.
Implementation intentions are the single most powerful compensation tool, boasting that robust D equals 0.65 effect size on goal achievement, particularly for those high impulsivity tasks.
The structural limit for high complexity, concurrent strategic work is 2 to 3 active projects maximum. Operating beyond that threshold pushes your effective productivity rapidly towards zero because of switching costs.
The human AI collaboration paradox requires intense focus on process design. that G equals minus 0.23 average underperformance reverses for creative tasks, demonstrating that the quality of the process, the Centaur Chess Protocol, matters more than raw capability.
And finally, strategic selection is not about predicting the perfect outcome. Expert entrepreneurs use effectual logic. They start with their means, they focus on affordable loss. The core strategic advantage lies in control, valuing the ability to pivot and redeploy resources over the effort spent on superior initial prediction.
The research forces us to end by asking a final provocative question for you. Identify the cognitive architecture you operate within. Are you primarily a predictor, constantly trying to force certainty and optimize the choice from the start? Or are you a controller who accepts uncertainty and needs robust, predictable systems, the implementation templates, the MVS, the quarterly cadence for effective resource redeployment?
Understanding which part of your greatest strength requires the most structural support is the definitive first step toward transforming possibility into strategic reality. Find full research and sources at research.yuda.me, that's Y-U-D-A.me,